Climate Access had the opportunity to review Climate Communicator George Marshall's new book, Don't Even Think About It, Why Our Brains Are Wired to Ignore Climate Change, which will be released in North America on August 19th and in the UK on October 9th. George Marshall is the founder of the Climate Outreach Information Network, based in the UK, and is with me today to chat about his book. Thank you for joining me, George.
Thank you, Amy.
I really enjoyed your book, although I will admit that some parts were uncomfortable reminders of ways that I personally have tried to communicate climate change in the past.
Right.
Mistakes, of course, I'll never make having read your book now. Why is what you're saying in this book relevant to climate change communicators, do you think?
I think we have to recognize that climate change is really all about communication. For a long time, because it came out of the science, we've assumed, following the science, that it's about conveying the facts to people. But it's very clear that what people are really holding on to is not so much the scientific facts as the social facts, the language which is built around it, the narratives, the storylines, and they're judging this issue on the basis of both that language, but also of the communicator, their assessment of the reliability of the people who are telling them this. So, from every point of view, climate change is not just about communicating, it is communications. And there's a very useful analysis that would see climate change as being what is sometimes called a wicked problem. A wicked problem is a problem that shapes itself, that morphs itself around the form that it is given. That is to say that you say it's this kind of problem, we can solve it this way, and it becomes that thing. It slivers. It's what I sometimes call a jelly mold issue. It becomes the thing that you make it. I think that is another reason why we need to be very careful as communicators, because, of course, even without recognizing it, we are shaping climate change in our own image. That's to say that we are inevitably giving it the shape and form of our own values and our own politics. We have to recognize that bias is kicking in as well. And I think that what I say a lot in the book, which is clear, that if we're really going to build conviction, that's to say sort of really strong socially formed belief in climate change, it has to be done on the way of finding new ways of speaking to different values. So we have to find a way of opening up the discussion and the debate. And that's central to our work as communicators.
I thought that was an interesting thing, especially in terms of using extreme weather events as teachable moments. I thought it was really interesting, the example in your book, where people who had experiences with extreme weather were less likely to take a step back and take the opportunity to talk about climate. It seems like the key there is having trusted messengers within the community, because after a disaster, advice from outsiders won't be taken as well.
Well, I think we can see that with any kind of issue that is regarded as being politically motivated, these issues become very emotionally charged, and people feel that it is inappropriate for outsiders to talk about it, especially if they think those outsiders have political motivations. What, of course, you're quite right, Amy, what breaks this pattern is when that conversation is happening internally between people who trust each other and who see the other person as being somebody who shares their values and worldview. So I think what tends to happen is we know that when people go through a traumatic event, it tends to pull people together, or at least it does the first time it happens. A lot of it keeps happening and happening with these major weather events. And this strong sense of social cohesion makes people hold together, makes them suspicious of people from outside, but also makes them have a very strong sense of shared identity. That means on the one hand, of course, that's going to make them very wary of issues like climate change, which could be seen as being divisive. Especially if it's seen to be political. But on the other hand, it really means that there's a lot of potential there for people within the communities to be having a conversation with each other.
I also really liked your idea of allowing people the space to grieve, and to not only grieve over, you know, what is happening to the planet and the things that we're losing, but also to grieve for the end of the era of fossil fuels.
I I really wanted to, in the book, I wanted to put that out. I don't explore it in any great depth, but to put it out as a little taster, because I think as I've been exploring this, the thing which has become aware to me repeatedly is that the way we talk about climate change is a very limited part of the wider potential conversations that could be happening, both in terms of the values and the framing of it, but also the whole subject matter of it. So when we talk about grieving and when we talk about impacts, it's true that we tend to talk very much in this very literal way about grieving or the climate change impacts, rather than maybe having a sense of letting go of maybe what's being lost. And that, again, is different from saying we must stop doing these things. It's about, in order to let go of something, you have to actually come to terms with the fact that it was really great and fun, that things have to move on. In the book, I said that the low carbon world will have new pleasures, but no longer the sweet roar of the Ford Mustang V8. So the reason I kind of mention these things is that there's romance there, and there's things which speak to very deep emotional values. It's not just about mobility. It's about the thrill and excitement of it. It's an example, I think, of how as environmentalists we tend to frame our messaging in terms of a set of values which are really quite culturally biased. In every environmental documentary on climate change, for example, you'll see footage in it of freeways presented as a problem, or rather we can read them as being presented as a problem because it's a value which we kind of understand the code for. But of course for other people, freedoms are freeways are a source of huge excitement, of energy, of freedom, of mobility. This is a very peculiar issue for the fact that we all contribute directly to it. I don't think we quite understand that. We're very used to political issues which are things where someone else is doing it and there's a clear enemy and somebody else is to blame. We don't really quite understand that this is an issue where our own contribution can be measured.
Yeah, it's always difficult to kind of wrap your head around the idea that there's a good guys and bad guys frame that we always reach for. But when you are also possibly the bad guy because we're all contributing to this, it really makes it difficult.
I think the important thing, though, to say for this as communicators is that really the best communicator is always going to be somebody who comes from the cultural values of the people that they're communicating with. And that means then that therefore, as an environmentalist, say, there is a limit to my usefulness as a communicator. A lot of my work with the Climate Outreach Information Network, the non-profit in Britain I helped found 10 years ago, a lot of my recent work has been working with new audiences, in particular conservatives, trying to find ways that we can encourage and enable conservative communicators, that's to say people of centre-right, not far-right politics, but centre-right politics, to communicate with each other. And I think this is very important, that we see the task of communication not just in terms of what we ourselves do, but also as second-order communicators. How can we enable and energize other people to speak with each other? And this, to me, as an activist, feels like a very rich and promising area to work. And I think it's been a curse for climate change that we have for so long kept it within this environmental box, but this is an environmental issue, and that therefore environmentalists are the ones who campaign on it, and that it's dealt with by environmental media correspondents and environmental politicians or policymakers. And this is a very good example of how we have really limited our options by talking about it in just one way, rather than talking about it as a human rights issue or a social rights issue. Or talking with conservatives in America, I had the pleasure, I mean, actually it was a pleasure, I really enjoyed it, of talking with people about very different politics from my own. And I was kept thinking, why on earth aren't we talking about climate change as a threat to people's freedom or a threat to people's property? I spent a day with the Tea Party in mid-Texas, and we talked a lot about this. And I just thought, this is just so stupid. These are very active, very energized people. They should be very involved with this issue, not denying it. They should be out there and fighting for it, because it's a threat to the things which are important to them, to their values.
Well, and also in terms of the language that gets used, I mean, one of the classic cases was the IPCC report saying that, you know, very certain is 95%, whereas for anyone who says they're very certain they're going to turn up to brunch, it means that maybe they'll show up. You know, it's like the rule on Facebook. If you click yes, it's a maybe. If you click maybe, it's a no. And the IPCC hasn't managed to work that out. But do you think that the use of the carbon budget framing that they put in the fifth assessment report was kind of a step in the right direction in terms of looking at, you know, a hard cap on the amount of fossil fuels that we can actually burn into the atmosphere?
The thing to remember in terms of the IPCC is that nothing they say on communications has been properly tested. So there's a lot of assumptions built into it. It's an interesting thing that scientists come from background of earth sciences don't seem to quite appreciate, but actually communications is a science too. I think you know how there's always this idea that all we need to do to communicate climate change is to throw information at people. Of course, the proof that that doesn't work is that for 20 years, communicators have been trying to say to scientists how they might be able to do things better, and the scientists haven't paid much attention to that either. I think a very good example of that, which causes me a lot of concern, is this widespread language around the so-called scientific consensus, that you can communicate climate change and persuade people of it by saying, well, we added up all of the scientific papers and 97% say that climate change is being caused by human activities. Of course, what people do, and I find myself doing it too, when I hear something like 97%, so I go, I'm very interested in that 3%. I want to know a bit more about that. Because, you know, the way that human brains work is that we're very interested in the individual. So the idea that there might be some dissenters out there who are standing outside the forces of conformity and are actually standing up for truth and honesty and what they believe in is a very appealing narrative. So actually saying 97% tends to draw attention to that. Because there's a whole lot of competing metaphors around climate change, which gets talked about. You know, it gets talked about as a gamble, or you know, as a virus, or you know, as an economic threat or a resource threat. I'd like to know that when people are using this language, that they would be doing it on the basis of really knowing whether that language works for people they're speaking to.
So finally, you at the end of the book, you call for the creation of non-negotiable sacred values, which are, you know, similar to the non-negotiable things that people agree on when they're within a religion. Do you think that doing that would be a process of relearning how to have values-based conversations rather than the attempt that we've had since the Enlightenment to divorce our emotional selves from our rational selves? Or do you think it's something else?
I think, again, it is a question rather than an answer. The question is, how can we talk about climate change, or maybe how can we talk about the weather as a whole and all of the things that depend on it as a non-negotiable sacred value? And then beyond that question of saying, well, what might that look like? So I can't say, there's no formula for this. You can't say, well, this is how you talk about it. I think it's more an issue of, can we find a different way of framing it? And I believe that we can. And I think, again, that takes a different shape for different audiences. I think different audiences have different sets of values, which is what's important to them. But the idea of sacred value is, although the word sacred suggests something religious, actually the literature around it is much more varied than that. For people of religious faith, of course, they have a whole set of sacred values. But for people who are atheists or non-religious, I think we all have things which are non-negotiable. I think the point is that for different people with different values, those what is non-negotiable lies in different places. As I've said, I think for people of conservative politics, that lies around issues of personal responsibility, of freedom. I think particularly in America, issues of property, issues concerning the role of government. The American right is very strongly rooted in the idea of independence. I think that's the place to look for the language of climate change. I think for people of the left, I think that there's a much stronger language around the non-negotiability of rights. There's been much too little conversation about rights there's been much too little involvement, to be honest, for people who are concerned with social rights. And I'm keenly aware, speaking with, again, people who I hadn't spoken with before, of evangelical leaders, but there is language there that they talk about in terms of how they understand and build people's conviction, which is completely missing from climate change. Issues of issues, for example, of recognizing that belief in things is sometimes questioned and it sometimes slips. Realizing that if you give people a very heavy moral package, as we often do with climate change, of saying this is wrong, but you need to have some language in there of forgiveness. We have no language of forgiveness in climate change. So we just say it's your fault, you did it, you're to blame. There doesn't seem to be any language of getting out of that. And understanding that sometimes you need to reach out to people and say, look, this is important, I care about this, I'd like you to be a part of this as well. So recognizing there's a whole social aspect to communities of shared belief that I think as a movement we need to be reaching out much more and saying this is important to us and this is what we believe.
Well, it sounds like we've definitely all got a lot of work to do. Thank you so much for taking the time to speak with me today, George. George Marshall's book, Don't Even Think About It, Why Our Brains Are Wired to Ignore Climate Change, is out in North America on August 19th and in the UK on October 9th. Thanks so much for talking with me, George.
And Amy, thank you very much. I really enjoyed that.